You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. And if you were listening last week to Science Friday, you heard Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIH tell us about a vaccine against bird flu that is going to start clinical trials soon. You might also have heard him say that there is no way to get everyone immunized around the world should bird flu learn how to easily infect people. Hundreds of millions of people might need a flu shot, but it's just not possible to make that much vaccine. For example, right now, just two companies supply all the flu vaccine for a regular flu season in the U.S., and you remember what happened last flu season. We didn't have enough to go around just here. So we're going to take a closer look of why that is. What is wrong with our vaccine supply system? What does the future hold for vaccines? Including the idea that some universities are trying. They're looking into getting into the local vaccine business, supplying vaccines to their own states. Is that the future, getting into the vaccine business? We'll talk about that also. So for the rest of the hour, science and the economics of vaccine production. And if you'd like to join our discussion with a question, a comment, please feel free to do so. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, if you want more information, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Gary Nabel is the director of the Vaccine Research Center at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. That's part of NIH. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Nabel.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Frank Sloan is the J. Alexander McMahon Professor of Health Policy, Law and Management, and Professor of Economics at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Sloan.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You've written extensively about vaccines and shortages. We saw that huge shortage of flu vaccine this winter. It's not the first time. What is the problem with our vaccine supply system?
Well, the problem is we don't have enough vaccine manufacturers interested in making vaccine, particularly for this market. We had three, actually. There's a third vaccine manufacturer, MedImmune, which produces live vaccine, but relatively few doses. But we lost one of the big ones, and this is because they're not more in there at, making vaccine, and also it's very difficult to do, and safety problems arose, and this one manufacturer was just shut down.
Well, knowing these limits, are you fearful that should this bird flu turn into a pandemic, we're going to be caught very short?
Very short, because what we were talking about this year is vaccinating about 50 to 60 million persons. Actually, there's even a slight surplus in some areas, mm-hmm. even though we lost the one manufacturer. And we would be talking about vaccinating many times that, just in the U.S., not to mention the world.
Mm-hmm. You suggested a reworking of the vaccine supply system in the U.S. to try to overcome this vulnerability to the shortages when something goes wrong. What are your thoughts on how that should be remade?
Well, I chaired a study that the Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences, conducted. And recommended that the federal government require that certain vaccines be part of the insurance benefit package. And then we proposed a way that the federal government could subsidize the vaccine, and so that the insurer wouldn't totally pay be at cost for that vaccine. And then we proposed a way of handling a vaccine for the uninsured, which would be a voucher system. That isn't the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. One could have the federal government buy all the vaccine and distribute it, but then we still got the distribution problem. Our approach emphasized distributing vaccines through private doctors' offices, so one would go to one's regular physician and get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. But in a pandemic, certainly if those routes are not well developed, this could be really something, because we just won't have time to both manufacture the vaccine and distribute it. And if we had one of these safety glitches like we did last fall, it would really be bad.
Mm-hmm. And so what has happened to those proposals that you and the committee have come up with?
Nothing. That's the problem, is that vaccines get a lot of attention when there's some scare in the media. And then the minute that's over, people not only don't get vaccinated, but they forget to pressure their elected representatives. Mm-hmm. So very little is happening. I mean, there is some there is an action plan for avian flu. But if you read the plan carefully, there are a lot of, we've got to decide this, we've got to decide that. Public health departments need to be vigilant and all that. But mm-hmm. it's all on paper. And mm-hmm. the question is, how well are we going to be able to translate the paper to action, and action within the right amount of time?
Mm. Dr. Nabel, do you share these concerns?
Well, I think these, yes, I do share the concerns. I think that we have seen this problem recur over the years, that we've really had a chronic shortage of vaccine suppliers. And I think, to make a long story short, the cause of it really is one that relates to the market for vaccines, that when you deal with the pharmaceutical industry, they have a choice to make vaccines or to make drugs. And they find that drugs are more profitable and there's less incentive for them to make vaccines, particularly in the quantities that we need. And that's why we're flat-footed when it comes to making vaccines for these critical time periods.
I guess then the government doesn't view a pandemic as a national security problem.
Well, I would say that we view it as a national health risk. And I think the problem, as Dr. Sloan pointed out, is that it's just that. It's risk. We don't know for sure that the avian flu will cross over and become an actual outbreak. And even if we know that it, or thought that it would, we can't predict when it will be. It is a very high priority. The Department of Health and Human Services has an action plan. There are many aspects to it. They include drug and vaccine. But these kinds of plans can't be implemented overnight. And we're not to the point yet where we have the tools and the medicines in hand that we need to really combat the outbreak should it occur.
And the funding, as Dr. Sloan points out, there's really no money in the plan, is there?
There is money for the kinds of things that would lead us to the next level, but there certainly is not the money that would be required to do the manufacturing of the scale that he describes.
Mm-hmm. So what happens, let's just role play a little bit. What happens if and when we discover that somewhere in Asia the bird flu is now transmissible from person to person pretty easily? What wheels get set in motion?
Well, I can tell you some of them. It's a pretty extensive plan, but there are obvious public health measures where one would attempt to do the things that you can do easily and quickly, which is to try to quarantine infected individuals and to restrict the number of contacts. That's standard fare in the public health field, like we did for SARS. There would also be an effort to treat with antiviral drugs. There's at least one drug that has efficacy against the virus, Tamiflu, and there are some supplies that are being stockpiled. I think if there was evidence that the vaccine, the experimental vaccine that Dr. Fauci described to you last week, was working, there would certainly be an effort to ramp up production of that as quickly as possible. I think what you have to do, though, is you have to look at any response that we have to any infectious outbreak as a staged process. There are the things that we can do immediately, there are the things that we can do short-term, and then there are the longer-term solutions. And so I think when and if it should break out, we will use whatever tools are there at the time and certainly try to get the newer generation of vaccines in place in time, if that's at all humanly possible.
The president views war on terrorism as a major risk. Why is there not the same urgency with something that, in terms of a massive loss of life, or in the United States, why isn't there that kind of urgency of let's buy those, let's ramp up, let's make those, you know, of those flu shots now, Dr. Sloan?
Well, I mean, the ramping really can be in terms of just the regular flu. If, in fact, 100 to 200 million doses were administered, and we had a system for administering the flu that is administered every year, then it would be easier to deal with a pandemic of this kind. Because one of the problems is we can talk about the kind of vaccine, but here we're talking about the cooperation of physicians' offices, pharmacies, mm-hmm. hospitals, state and local health departments. There's so many players here.
And they're all going to need money to function with this.
And they're going to need money to function, but it also would – I would feel better that if 192 million people would benefit from the flu vaccine currently, that we had that level. We had more manufacturers involved, so we had the production capacity. One of the problems is you don't just overnight build a plant and get it licensed mm-hmm. to manufacture this vaccine. Clearly, it's going to be another strain, but presumably there's some benefit from having, if we're still using the egg-based technology, of having the chickens around mm-hmm. and having the factories around and having the workers around and having the distribution channels around. And that just can't be done by a federally alone. I mean, this involves people in every community in the country.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nabel, how close are we to getting rid of this egg-based? This is the 21st century. It's hard to believe we're still doing these things with eggs.
Well, you know, as you point out, I think there are many opportunities now to advance the technology of vaccine production, and I think there are some important opportunities for us, not only for flu vaccine, but for other vaccines. For example, with the smallpox vaccine, there was recently a transition from the old style of making the smallpox vaccine, which literally was on the backs of cows, recently that's been converted now to a cell-based production system. So we are in fact moving and testing new technologies. They include the use of recombinant DNA to make these new flu strains. We in fact, in the case of the avian flu, we were able to make the prototypes for the new experimental vaccine much more quickly by using some recombinant DNA techniques. We can also grow them on cell lines, and there is a regulatory process that we go through to make sure that it's safe, but there are now lines that are suitable for this kind of production. And so I think this is part of the general move in the infrastructure that will put us in a better position to respond more quickly down the road.
Talking about making enough vaccine for all kinds of flu outbreaks this hour, and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to Rachel in Novato, California. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious, with the tsunami relief, how much money went and is still coming in to help. It just seems that it shouldn't be so difficult to distribute this vaccine and to get the money, and especially like we have Red Cross in almost every city, and even starting there, and because you said there's problems with distribution, and I'm just wondering, why can't we just get it together like we do with everything else, with all these great minds we have in government?
If we can put a man on the moon, why can't we make enough vaccine?
Exactly.
Well, I mean, we found in the last in the current situation that the vaccine was in one place and it needed to be in another. You have issues of across international boundaries. We thought, well, we didn't have enough vaccine, so why not get vaccine from Germany? In a pandemic, Germany will be very eager to have its own vaccine. The people won't be terribly willing to send it over here. You also have issues of how you distribute it within the country. It's not clear that, in other markets, I mean, clearly we get food is distributed every day, and it somehow gets distributed to the right place.
Why don't we just say we're going to set this up and do it? We're going to make enough vaccine. We're going to have a national effort to make a distribution system that will work for all kinds of viral outbreaks, and do it.
Yeah, I think doing it, if we could do it with the vaccines, that, you know, with the diseases that we're now vaccinating for, that would be a good trial run. The problem is that a lot of people aren't getting vaccinated, and a lot of people don't know where it's available. So if we could improve the existing system, I think we would be halfway there, particularly when we see the technological change that was discussed a few minutes ago.
Now,
but that's in the in the production of vaccine.
Let's go to that direction, because one of the problems we keep hearing, and I think you mentioned it before, is that drug companies would rather make the high-profit drugs than the vaccines that they don't think they're going to make any money on.
Right.
Past that problem?
We do have problems. The drug manufacturers regard vaccines as commodities. A lot of them are off patent. Mm-hmm. You know, they're interested in selling products that are on patent. Many of the vaccines are only used once. Pneumococcal vaccine. The flu vaccine is only used once a year. Contrast that with a statin, that is for people with high cholesterol, which is used daily.
You're never going to get cured of that, so you can buy that all the time.
So you buy that all the time, so it's a much bigger market.
So how do we get past that?
We need to have public, we need to have federal support.
Tell me what that means, federal support.
That means that we have to decide that this is what it's worth, that we're willing to pay this much money to, like we are doing in bioterrorism. Bioterrorism is attracting a lot of money, but we haven't been able to find that kind of money for vaccines. I may be wrong, but I haven't read about it, that where we are really spending, making substantial in-advance commitments. You know, we could say to companies, look, we're talking about a market of 300 million doses. We're talking about this is the kind of price that we'll be willing to pay for this. And that will elicit not only R&D, but it will elicit investments in production capacity, in personnel, and everything else that you need for this.
What kind of price per dose could – let's set a market here. If I said to you, we have 300 million doses, we're going to need, what, $10 a dose, $100? What kind of money are we talking here?
Well, I mean, it would be related to the benefit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we're going to lose, if say we had in 1918, we lost 500,000 lives.
That's just in this country.
Just in this country, it was 20 to 50 million lives worldwide. That's a lot of lives.
Right, well, hang on to that thought, because it is a lot of lives, 20 to 40 million worldwide, and that could happen again if we get another pandemic. So it's worth thinking about. We have to take a short break. We'll come right back and talk more about flu and the vaccines and how to make more of them. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about vaccine shortages, what to do about them, with Gary Nabel of the NIH and Frank Sloan of Duke University. Dr. Sloan, when I rudely interrupted you, you were going to try to give us some sort of plan that might help, or give us some idea of the costs and how we might make, how much we might charge for these, and can we get out of this quagmire?
Well, I mean, I don't know that we would lose 500 lives in the U.S. As in 1918, or 20 to 50 million worldwide. I mean, what we have going for us is that we have a better health system, and we have better methods of quarantining, and we have antivirals. On the other hand, people get around a lot more than they used to. And even in 1918, this pandemic spread all over the world. And that was before jets and other methods of transportation that we use. And we were much less numerous. Cities were much smaller. What I'm saying is that that for any kind of intervention that can save even, say, one-tenth the number of lives, or one-fifth the number of lives, 100,000 lives in the U.S. And a few million worldwide, that one can show using cost-benefit analysis that this benefit is tremendous. Sometimes we use in these calculations, we use 100,000 a life year. Here, what we're doing is, when we're talking about influenza, often we would be talking about very elderly people who might have died 3 or 4 months or a year before they would have died from something else. Here, with a pandemic, we're talking about losing lives of people that are much younger than this.
So even the cold numbers make sense to to go ahead.
Yes, the cold number. I think you can make a rational calculation. Yeah. And certainly relative to the deaths that we talk about, we talk about we talk about almost as many lives due to smoking that are lost every year, 430,000 lives a year, and we haven't been able to develop a national strategy. But most diseases that we talk about are much less deadly than this.
Mm-hmm. That's arguing for to drug companies to go ahead and make the dosages because it's worth it in dollars and cents.
They're going to need the incentives because they don't trust that when push comes to shove that somebody will say, here's $10 a dose, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this, even with all those doses, turns out to be a losing proposition.
Well, let's talk with someone who's got some creative thinking going on here. Jeffrey Romoff is the president of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, part of University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday. You're not going to wait for other people to build vaccine plants? You're going to make a vaccine plant yourself?
Well, we're certainly looking at the feasibility of making a vaccine plant now. But I think we've got a very interesting conversation and a solution in more vaccine plants, but a solution not quite to the most important problem. The most important problem, which I think Dr. Sloan was moving towards, is the complete absence of a biosecurity infrastructure in the United States and in the world. I think the fact that we look at health issues as different from terroristic issues is a mistake. For example, the tragedy here in New York at the Twin Towers, where approximately 3,000 people were lost, doesn't compare to even the benign forms of flu where last year it's estimated 36,000 people were killed. However, we were all terrorized. When we saw an envelope full of white powder in the capital of the United States, we were all terrorized and the government came to a halt at least for 48 hours. Now, what is the difference between the response to a sense of terrorism and the response to what is benignly called a public health problem like the flu? The difference is the sense of unexpected terror, unexpected tragedy, unexpected problem, and the lack of predictability. Now, let's take the avian flu. I would ask you to imagine how everyone would respond if we just announced that the avian flu is coming to the United States, has a 70% rate of death as a result of it, and the symptom presentation is a running nose, a sore throat, moderate levels of fever, and swollen parts of your body. Symptoms I would suggest virtually all of your listeners, including me, have had over the last month or two. There would likely be panic, and health workers would be in panic. Physicians would be in panic, citizens would be in panic, police officers would be in panic. And where would they turn? They would turn, obviously, to the biosecurity infrastructure, the coordination of healthcare facilities, first responders, ambulances, governmental officials. And they would turn to the very place where there would be no coordinated response.
It's a chilling scenario. But any reason, Dr. Nabel, to disagree with that scenario?
No, I think that that he's quite right, that there's an important psychology here. And I do think, for example, that there is some infrastructure that's pretty much run by the Centers for Disease Control. But I agree that it's not one that's robust and that can probably meet the demand of an acute crisis. But I think one of the very important points to recognize in this discussion is that what we see time and again when we have this clamor for vaccines is that we have this crisis situation, whether it be anthrax, whether it be SARS, whether it now be avian flu, and that creates almost a fire drill where we say, okay, now we have to do everything possible to create security around this bio threat. And then sometimes the problem gets worse, but often it goes away. And SARS being a very good example where it's been contained, and you can see now that a company wanting to make a vaccine for SARS, where two years ago that seemed to be a very, very important thing to do, there is not a single company that would regard that as an important priority right now.
But we're not talking about, I mean, from what I hear by other guests saying, is that we can't leave it up to the companies, that the government has to act to take over where the companies, you know, we don't want to leave our future in the hands of the drug companies.
Well, I agree. I think, though, that the key is that the government can't do it all alone. I think we need private-public partnerships. And I agree that we need a more concerted approach to biosecurity. I think to some extent the additional research that's going on now in the area of biodefense can help propel that effort forward. But it's got to go beyond the research. It's got to go into the public health system and the complete spectrum from making the new vaccines, making the antivirals, all the way to the person in the clinic who will be given this medicine.
I agree 100% with Dr. Nabel, and that's precisely what we at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center are attempting to do. The vaccine plan for us is only one piece of a continuum of care. The UPMC is responsible for about 50% of the care that is administered to Western Pennsylvania. We've invested about $500 million in information systems that will allow us to understand when someone walks in anywhere in Western Pennsylvania to any emergency room with what set of symptoms and be able to respond to those kinds of symptoms. We are building an infrastructure with first responders. We are seeking to build a major regional biosecurity base, which incorporates all the elements we've discussed, so that we can become a model for the nation.
Including making the vaccine?
Including making the vaccine. And the reason this making of the vaccine in our discussion up to now and in the public discussion has a certain static element to it. It's as if you're making to a vaccine one time for something that's known and doesn't mutate. Mm-hmm. The dirty little secret is that we in laboratories can create any kind of pathogen we actually want. Why we think that in 10 years from now that won't be able to be done in a desert or in a jungle or by another industrialized nation, I don't know. I don't know why we don't understand that really the process is not to make a vaccine in a fixed point of time, and as Dr. Nabel says, it goes away. If someone, we can have a situation where things mutate, where you have to understand what it is immediately when it appears, have a capacity to develop a response to it, whether it be a combination of quarantine or vaccination or treatment protocols, and then be prepared to handle the next tranche of a problem. So this is a continuous process in its worst-case scenario, not a stagnant process that comes, we rest for a decade, and goes away.
How many places – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, there's one area, though, we do need federal attention. That is in financing. Mm-hmm. That you, this is like during the Cold War. I mean, we didn't have a whole lot of missiles coming at us from the Soviet Union, but somehow we were able to sustain funding. And maybe there were different weapons and different technologies for delivering and so forth. The parallel isn't perfect, but it wasn't totally static. But yet we had the federal government behind the financing. The hardware was built by the private sector. A lot of the delivery was done by the private sector, but the basic financing was federal. I mean, this is a case that you could be an Adam Smith economist that you would say that there's a role for government here.
Federal government is hurting so much for money now. The deficit, the revamping the Social Security, the healthcare systems. How are you going to convince? And, you know, we've talked today and at other times about how much money is being taken out of the science community and other areas to save money. Do you really think that the government is going to step in now and start buying hundreds of millions of doses of a vaccine that they may not use?
I think Dr. Sloan is exactly accurate. And I think the model here to use for federal government funding is not the public health model, but the defense model. That is precisely, the government gets engaged as a result of the terroristic attack in New York. Somehow, whether we all agree that one related to another, we committed $300 billion to the war on terror as expressed at least in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, whatever you think about it, someone mobilized to use mostly Defense Department resources and governmental resources to do that. I think the question is mobilizing the same kind of biosecurity, biodefense resources in, to complement what we're doing in the more traditional ways. This is where this country is going to be vulnerable. And the model of having federal stimulation, support of the beginning, and then having it flow into the private community and entrepreneurial community, I think, is precisely the model. And I'm, if I understand what Professor Sloan is saying,
that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, mm-hmm. Let me just jump in and remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
So, where is the pressure going to bubble up to create this in this model, or to use the model? How is that going to happen, Dr. Sloan?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, it happens when we talk about it. That
we talk is cheap, as I say all the time.
Talk is very cheap, but talk is a part of it. The problem is that the stories get people interested, but because you can't see it, you don't have a friend who has it, it just goes away, and this is a real challenge. So it really takes leadership. Hopefully we'll get somebody on the Hill or someone in the administration who takes on the charge. But we just have to keep talking about it.
Dr. Nabel, any reaction?
I agree with the idea that the defense industry model is one that could be applied here to great benefit. You know, it's very interesting if you go back and read the historical accounts during World War II, of how we built up the defense industry to counter the threat in Europe. We didn't really have a big defense industry, and we had to create one out of the automotive industry and really small industry. And in many ways, that's the analogy here for vaccines. We're trying to create the security from biotech, from the academic side, from some government's efforts, and a little bit of pharmaceutical. A good plan, a coherent plan with some support from the government to help that along, I think would go a long way. And I do think that leadership, particularly among from our politicians, will really help to drive this process forward.
You know, one of the phrases that came out of the reason why we were 9/11 happened is that there was a failure of the imagination. Is there a failure of the imagination here in perceiving the kind of threat that could happen if some sort of that eventually or might happen if a virus, a bird flu virus, is able to mutate and it's spread worldwide? Is there a failure of imagination here?
I think there's a terrible failure of imagination, and there's a failure of focus. And I think we in the public health and healthcare world contribute to it mostly because the country separates health issues as different from biosecurity issues. And we have to start to make precisely this linkage. This is a terrorism issue. This is a protection issue. This is saving the country. All the kinds of wonderful patriotic expressions we've learned to use or at least be inundated with from our politicians over these last years after 9/11 need to be applied to this kind of a risk. Most intelligent commentators feel that this is a far more present and real risk over the next decade or two to the well-being of this country and the well-being of the world than anything, even including nuclear armament. This is something that can be handled by a single person, can be spread easily, can occur naturally, and it can occur as a deliberate attack. Also, I think using the defense model, one of the interesting spin-offs of the defense model is, and relating to the issue of the patent issue and the issue of how do you make a profit on this, is that if we actually develop the capacity, and this is thinking we have it at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, to respond to a pathogen in a quick and immediate way, we may have the capacity also to develop cures for cancer, because the word vaccine, as applied to major diseases, is also a capacity.
All right. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Linking it to cancer is a good way to get attention to it. Let me thank all of you. Eric Larson, Director of Center for Health Studies at the Group Health Cooperative in Seattle, Frank Sloan of Duke University, and Gary Nabel of the NIH. Thank you all for taking and also Jeffrey Romoff, thank you all for taking time to talk with us today.